The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
When theologians get together and biblical scholars address the whole issue of the Bible's teaching on male-female relationships, the discussion usually begins in the first couple of chapters of Genesis. There is, of course, biblical warrant for this approach, because whenever the Apostle Paul talks about this subject, he normally makes Genesis 1-3 foundational to his argument. So it's not surprising that a great battle has raged over these chapters. Do they support an egalitarian view of marriage? Do they support an hierarchical model of male-female relationships? The exegetical decisions that we make here will influence the shape of the interpretation of many, many texts that follow after Genesis. Now, it's not my intention here to examine every passage in the first three chapters of Genesis that bears upon the question of male-female relationships, but I would like to briefly discuss traditionalist and feminist interpretations of one verse, Genesis 2:18, because I believe that it raises some important questions that might be better understood when we come to examine the patriarchal narratives. Chapter 2 of Genesis is where the divergence between traditionalists and feminists can be most clearly seen. Despite the very different understanding, though, of a number of the verses, the two sides are surprisingly similar in the way they interpret verse 18. This is how the NIV translates that verse. "The Lord God said, 'It is not good for man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him.'" Now, in previous centuries, it was assumed that helper implied inferiority. Augustine believed that Eve's help was limited to procreation because, and I quote, "she was of small intelligence and lives more in accordance with the promptings of the inferior flesh than by superior reason." Calvin was more succinct, but no more complimentary when he wrote that Eve was an inferior aid to Adam. But modern exegesis of Genesis 2:18 doesn't talk very much. In fact, it avoids talking altogether about inferiority. For feminists, that is clearly a matter of necessity. The most influential modern interpretation of this verse comes from the feminist scholar Phyllis Trible in her 1973 article Depatriarchalizing in Biblical Interpretation, and also in her 1978 book God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality. She argued since the Hebrew word ezer, usually translated help or helper, since this word is used with reference to God, it cannot be, well, usually when God is acting as the helper of Israel, it cannot be taken to denote inferiority of any kind. This line of argument has proved to be very persuasive, not only among feminists in the critical tradition, but also among conservative, even inerrantist evangelicals. Gilbert Bilozikian of Wheaton College is one example. In his 1985 book, Beyond Sex Roles, he writes, "It is now a matter of general knowledge that this Hebrew word for helper is not used in the Bible with reference to a subordinate person, such as a servant or underling. It is generally attributed to God when he is engaged in activities of relief and rescue among his people. Consequently, the word helper may not be used to draw inferences about subordinate female roles. If anything, the word points to the inadequacy and helplessness of man when he was bereft of woman in Eden." Yet the same argument can be found in the writings of hierarchicalists as well. Although they find evidence elsewhere in Genesis 2 that women should be subject to men, such is not the case here in Genesis 2:18. Susan Foe, in her 1979 book, Women and the Word of God, argues, again I quote, "that it can safely be said that ezer," this word for helper, "does not imply inferiority." James Hurley, writing in Man and Woman in Biblical Perspective, says that woman's role as an appropriate helper does not carry with it an implication of subordination. Furthermore, modern commentators, feminist and traditionalist, no longer speak of Eve as Adam's helper only in procreation. She is now seen to be in a more well-rounded relationship with Adam. She is the one who fills the emotional vacuum in Adam's life. Feminists in the critical tradition at this point are almost indistinguishable from evangelical traditionalists when they describe Eve's relationship to Adam, the way that Eve helps Adam. A couple of examples. Phyllis Tribble writes, "When the earth creature," that's her way of referring to Adam, "when the earth creature needs, what the earth creature needs is a companion, one who is neither subordinate nor superior, one who alleviates isolation through identity." The evangelical feminist Bilezikian writes, "The image of God in Adam yearned for the presence of his female counterpart without whom there was no fulfillment." James Hurley, a traditionalist, writes, The man was not made to live without human companionship. To end the loneliness of man, God shaped a woman from the flesh of Adam." Recent commentaries on Genesis follow the same line. Gordon Wenham, in his recent Word series commentary on Genesis, writes, "The help looked for is not just assistance in his daily work or in the procreation of children, but the mutual support companionship offers." So in all traditions, it is agreed that the reason Adam needs a helper is because he's lonely. Eve helps Adam by bringing him companionship and personal fulfillment. In the rest of Genesis chapter 2, the differences between between feminists and traditionalists are more in evidence. A couple of examples. Traditionalists see that the significance in the fact that Eve is created second. While agreeing with feminists that man and woman are essentially equal, they argue that because Eve is created second, that indicates a difference in the way they are to function. Susan Foe puts it this way, "The woman followed his lead in the creation process, and she is to follow his lead as husband." But of course, feminists at this point disagree strongly with this interpretation. Eve's formation out of Adam is interpreted quite differently. His temporal priority is of little significance. Instead, emphasis falls on the fact that she is formed out of Adam and not out of the ground. Bilezikian writes, "She was made from the same material as his own body. From one being, God created two persons. Unlike Adam, she was made out of human flesh already in existence. Humanity twice refined, she is at least his equal." Now, these are typical interpretive differences between feminists and traditionalists. They are the stuff of the current debate. But what strikes me is how often the two sides agree. For all the talk about male headship and hierarchical, or as we are now supposed to call them, complementarian relationships, traditionalists are at pains to use expressions like functional subordination or situational subordination. Men and women are equal in every respect, except that traditionalists see that equality to be qualified, although not negated, in certain situations or in certain areas where men and women are intended to have differing functions. Feminists, of course, see no such qualification on this fundamental equality. But for all the huffing and puffing, everyone agrees. Men and women are intrinsically, fundamentally equal. As we noted, this agreement shows up most clearly with respect to Genesis 2:18. Whereas for older commentators, Eve was an inferior assistant whose help was limited to procreation, today's commentators, traditionalists and feminists, are more inclined to see the expression ezer kenegdo, the helper suitable for him, as an epithet of equality. And this status is confirmed by the fact that Eve acts as Adam's loving companion who relieves his loneliness. So, on this verse, the division is less feminist against traditionalist and more modern against pre-modern. So the areas of agreement and disagreement have been fairly clearly drawn, with feminists believing that Genesis 1-3 teaches an unadulterated equality. Traditionalists see it as teaching a modified equality. But in a recently published book entitled What Does Eve Do to Help?, David Clines from Sheffield University has put a cat among the pigeons and questioned whether Genesis 1-3 can be taken to support any model of equality between the sexes. In this book, he has a provocatively titled chapter. It's titled, What Does Eve Do to Help? And Other Irredeemably Androcentric Orientations in Genesis 1-3. Here he discusses a number of texts from these chapters and their relevance to the debate. But his primary challenge is directed against the view that sees Genesis 2:18 as affirming an egalitarian model. He mounts his challenge on two fronts. The first raises the question of how significant it is for this text, for 2:18, that God is elsewhere in the Bible called an Ezer, a helper. He writes, and I quote, "What I conclude from reviewing all occurrences of the root I and Z are in the Hebrew Bible is that although superiors may help inferiors, strong may help weak, gods may help humans, in the act of helping, they are being inferior. That is to say, they are subjecting themselves to a secondary, subordinate position. Their help may be necessary or crucial, but they are assisting some task that is already somebody else's responsibility. They are not actually doing the task themselves, for even in cooperation, for there is different language for that." The second challenge comes from asking a very simple question. What does Eve actually do to help Adam? After discussing the various tasks that God assigns to Adam, Kleins concludes that there is but one task that Adam cannot do alone, one task for which he needs an Ezer Kenegdo, a helper suitable or corresponding to him. And that task is to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth, Genesis 1:28. In other words, he revives the old argument of Augustine that women help men only in the process of procreation. Kleins, in effect, argues that our understanding of 2:18 is confused by the traditional translation of the first half of the verse, "It is not good for man to be alone," which suggests that the problem that Adam faced was loneliness. We noted how most modern commentators take this to mean that Eve fills an emotional vacuum in Adam's life. But the problem is that the Hebrew reads, "Lo tov hayot ha'adam levado," which is best translated as something like this: "The fact that the man is alone is not good." Now, if we retain the traditional translation, we should understand this verse to be saying, "It is not good for man to be alone," rather than the way we tend to take it, "It is not good for the man to be alone." There's a subtle difference in the way we read that, but quite significant in the way we interpret it. Kleins contends that this verse is not at all interested in Adam's psychological and emotional needs. God is not interested in whether Adam is lonely. His concern is that the fact of Adam's aloneness would prevent him from carrying out the task set before him in 1:28. At this point, enter the woman, to help Adam do what he cannot do alone, that is, bear children. And Kleins then notes the terms of the curse on Eve. "I will greatly increase your pain in childbearing. In pain, you will give birth to children." He argues that this confirms that the one thing she is created to do is to bear children. The one thing she is created to do is made more painful for her. Kleins concludes that in Genesis 2:18 and all other relevant texts in Genesis 1-3, there is no equality of the sexes. In these texts, which he calls indefeasibly androcentric, women are not worthless, but they are not equal to men. Now, we need to understand what Kleins is doing. Clearly, his attack is aimed primarily at feminists who have an optimistic view of what Genesis 1-3 says about the role of women. No doubt, some traditionalists will be pleased to see such a vigorous attack on feminist interpretations of Genesis. But Kleins should not be taken to read the text in the same way that modern traditionalists do. It must be remembered that although hierarchicalists use the language of functional subordinationism, that is set in the broader context of an affirmation of the essential equality of the sexes. Kleins goes much further and contends that the first three chapters of Genesis, and specifically 2:18, are radically patriarchalist in their orientation. If correct, the consequence would be that all notions of equality, be they according to feminist or traditionalist definitions, have been imported from somewhere outside the text. That Kleins has challenged the standard feminist interpretation of 2:18 is all well and good, but is he correct? On one hand, it appears to me that he has been too influenced by the way the word help is used in English, and he has not proved that the Hebrew word Ezer always infers inferior status of some type. He admits as much when he says that in his general study of the word, it has not been perhaps entirely adequate to establish the meaning of the word in its present context. He also does not adequately deal with the way the word kenegdo in the NIV suitable for him, how this word might influence whether we take helper to indicate inferiority or equality. My own understanding of this verse is that by itself, it leaves the question of inferiority or equality unanswered. When feminists like Tribble argue that because God is described as the helper of Israel in other texts, this means that Isaiah can imply superiority, all she is ultimately saying is that context determines the status of the helper. In Genesis 2:18 itself, we have no clear indication that the helper is inferior, equal, or even superior. That's the question we're trying to answer. Only context, narrowly and broadly defined, will help us. As for this word kenegdo, suitable for him, it is a virtual hapax, only occurring here and in verse 20. So we should be wary of arguments that confidently assert how we should understand it. We should also be suspicious of arguments like that raised by Ada Spencer, who argues that because the basic root of kenegdo is neged, and that means in front of, this implies that Eve was in front of Adam, and so implies at least female equality. But I think the context does not permit that level of precision. In 2:18 to 20, we are told that God plans to make a helper suitable for or corresponding to Adam. He then proceeds to create all the animals and brings them to the man so that he can name them. But among the animals, no such appropriate helper is found. This context helps us get closer to the significance of kenegdo. The animals are not suitable because they do not correspond to Adam because they are animals and not humans. The only appropriate helper is one who belongs to his species. What makes Eve and Isaiah kenegdo, a helper suitable to him, is not that she has equal status with him, but simply that she belongs to the same species. She is an Isha. She's a female version of the Ish, of the man. She's a woman and from the man. Kenegdo by itself does not say anything about the issue of equality between the sexes. So I think that Clines is on the right track when he asks the contextually oriented question, what does Eve do to help, as a way of determining whether she is equal or subordinate to Adam. But is Clines correct in limiting Eve's help to procreation? It seems to me that his answer is at least more textually based than those who argue that Eve's help relieves Adam's loneliness, an interpretation which to me seems to betray a typically Western interest in the individualistic and psychological dimension of human existence. To this discussion, I now wish to add the evidence of the patriarchal narratives to see whether they can help us determine what was the character of woman's role as helper and whether that role made her equal or subordinate to him. Now, some may object that the patriarchal narratives are irrelevant to the question of the status of women in Genesis 1 to 3. These earlier chapters describe the male-female relationship in the ideal pre-fallen world. The patriarchal narratives describe those relationships in a fallen world. The two historical settings differ so radically that they are incapable of mutual elucidation. But my interest in the patriarchal narratives is more at the level of narration than it is at the level of the events that the narration refers to. My concern is to enter the thought world of the narrator who is responsible for chapters 12 to 50, as well as chapters 1 to 3. The pre-fall, post-fall division is probably more significant for systematic theology than it is for Genesis itself, since the book has a narrative unity that transcends the historical discontinuity occasioned by the fall. For example, from the very beginning, the narrative is interested in God's command to be fruitful and multiply. This command becomes a motif around which much of the narrative is organized. It binds together elements from the primeval history on both sides of the fall and from the patriarchal narrative as well. The importance of this motif to the narrative is not significantly affected by the fact of the fall. Ultimately, then, our task is not to try and determine what was the status of women at the time of the patriarchs, but what was their status from the perspective of the author of Genesis. So we turn, at last, to the patriarchal narratives. And I wish to organize my remarks into three areas. Firstly, the role of women as mothers. Secondly, the priority of sons over daughters. And finally, I want to consider a tale of two daughters, Genesis 19:8, where Lot offers his daughters to the men of Sodom. Firstly, mothers. We begin by asking the question, what is the primary function of women in the patriarchal narratives? Let me assert before I prove. In Genesis, women exist to bear children and little else. Take Sarah. Her role in the narrative focuses on one question. Will she bear a son to Abraham? As important a character as Sarah is, her significance is limited to her function as a childbearer. She is judged to have achieved her narrative destiny only when she is able to bear Isaac to Abraham. It is not that she is only characterized as a childbearer, but on the few occasions the narrative describes Sarah apart from this function, the sensitive reader may detect an authorial ambivalence to her other qualities. For example, in 12:10-22, we are told that Sarah is beautiful, but this is the reason that Abraham decides to pass himself off as her brother when they are in Egypt, a situation that almost results in disaster. In chapter 16:2, Sarah shows great resourcefulness by suggesting to Abraham that he take Sarah as his concubine. But again, another chaotic situation results. If I may put it crassly, the author seems to be suggesting that beauty and resourcefulness are far less valuable attributes than the ability to bear children. I suggest that this orientation is confirmed by the way the narrative defines what it means for a woman to be blessed by God. First, listen to the way that God blesses Abraham in 12:2. He says, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. Abraham is this at the center of the blessing. But in 17:16, when God blesses Abraham, blesses Sarah, he promises to bless her by giving Abraham a son through her. The ultimate blessing for a woman was to bear a son to her husband, not just children, but a son to her husband. It is not a blessing that falls on her directly. She is blessed only by being enabled to play her role as childbearer and so permit the divine blessing to fall on Abraham and his seed. In chapter 24, Rebekah leaves her household to marry Isaac. Then the family offers this parting blessing. Our sister, may you increase to thousands and thousands. May your offspring possess the gate of your enemies. Now let's get a sense of the cultural distance between our world and theirs. Imagine, men, that it's your sister's wedding day and it's your chance to offer her a fraternal blessing. You would probably say something like, I hope that you are going to be really happy. I hope that your husband loves and cares for you. I hope that he brings out the best in you. I pray that your marriage will be everything that you dreamed it would be. Not so in Genesis. The blessing goes something like, I hope that you have lots and lots of kids for your husband. And I hope that your sons have success. How would you women feel if your brother gave you that fraternal blessing on your wedding day? Blessedness for a woman touches her life only insofar as she produces children, and especially sons. A woman's blessedness comes from knowing that her sons will be directly blessed. They will possess cities, but she herself is not directly blessed at all. The stories about Leah and Rachel have the same focus. Their purpose in the narrative is to bear the sons of Israel. The centrality of this function to their existence can be seen from 30 verse 1. Jacob loves Rachel more than Leah. In a polygamous marriage, surely that would place Rachel in the better position. No, Leah may not be loved as much as Rachel, but she bears children, she bears sons, so she is better off. So what does Rachel say to Jacob? She says, give me sons, or I die. Again, we have entered a very different thought world. I suspect that some in this room have wrestled with the problem of infertility, but I'm sure that you've dealt with it in a different way to what we find here. Would a wife today say to her husband, give me sons or I die? And would a husband answer with, am I in the place of God who has kept you from having children? An answer that assumes that childbearing is where the wife derives her identity. If I were to answer Rachel, I would say, your value to me does not depend on whether you can bear children or not. You are not a baby-making machine. But then I belong to a different world. In Genesis, a woman's value is primarily based upon her capacity to bear children, and especially sons. It is not argued, it is assumed. Even the puzzling story of Judah and Tamar in chapter 38 fits this picture. Tamar plays a prostitute and becomes pregnant to her father-in-law, Judah. Yet Judah judges her to be more righteous than he was because she had fulfilled her duty to her dead husband. She had borne sons to him through Judah. The whole story only makes sense when Tamar is defined as the one who helps her late husband be fruitful and multiply. Of course, Tamar is set in contrast to Potiphar's wife, whose interest in sex has nothing to do with bearing sons to her husband. She is the classic counterexample of a woman who rejects and steps outside the legitimate role assigned to women in the narrative. Now, these brief excerpts strongly suggest that in Genesis, the societal function of women is very circumscribed. In the narrative, they are valued primarily, if not exclusively, for their capacity to bear children. This may be offensive to our modern, indeed even to our Christian sensibilities, but we must be willing to accept the text on its own terms and to recognize the vast difference between the value systems of our society, including modern conservative evangelical circles, and the world which produced a text like Genesis. These examples also confirm the old interpretation that in Genesis, woman's role as a helper to man is precisely in her function as a childbearer. But then we have to ask the question, is childbearing a secondary or subordinate role? The evidence we've considered thus far describes the childbearing function of women not as an end in itself, but as something that helps the husband, helps him to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Now, many might feel comfortable with this and say that assigns to women a different task without any hint of inferior status. But it seems to me that the fact that the narrative limits women to a helping role raises the presumption that they are not just equal and different, but simply not equal at all. In fact, I believe that the very notion of male-female equality, however we define it, is foreign to the text. We need to ask ourselves whether the main reason we see equality in the text is because all of us, whether conservative or feminist, simply want to see it there. In discussing the question of women's status as childbearers, I will first make some general comments. Then I'll consider how the practice of polygamy affected women's status, and then finally in this section, I will discuss how Israelite views of how reproduction occurred are also relevant to this question. First, some general comments on the question of status, the status of women. We've noted that childbearing is not an end in itself because it's something that she does for her husband. Recall 17:15-16, where God promises to bless Sarah with a son. That promise is not even spoken to Sarah, but to Abraham, because the blessing of Sarah is ultimately for his benefit. Furthermore, the terms of the blessing of Sarah put Abraham and not Sarah at the center. I will bless her and will surely give you a son by her. The limited function of childbearing is also an auxiliary subordinate function. But beyond this general orientation, there is more specific evidence. The task of multiplying and being fruitful and multiplying is a big one, and men need all the help they can get. That's perhaps a crass way of putting it, but it does explain the practice of polygamy, or more correctly, polygyny, many wives. Abraham has two wives and a concubine, Jacob, two wives, two concubines, Esau, three wives. Now, the imbalance of this arrangement is significant. A man could be polygynous, but presumably a woman could not be polyandrous. This model implies that women were not equal partners with men in filling the earth. Rather, this state of affairs is more consistent with the view that sees men as performing this task, assisted by as many helpers as they deemed necessary. Now, the question of reproduction. Since procreation is a central theme in the patriarchal narratives, there is value in investigating the text's understanding of how reproduction occurs and how this affected its view of women's status. Notice how the language of procreation draws upon agricultural metaphors. Children, in 30 verse 2, are called fruit of the womb. The Hebrew word usually translated as offspring or descendants is zerah, seed. And the use of akara, barren, to describe a woman's childlessness may derive from agricultural imagery as well. I wish to suggest that behind this language lies a metaphor for describing how procreation took place. The role of the male was to plant the seed in the soil and the role of the female was to act as the soil to nurture and bring forth fruit. Modern anthropological studies shed further light on this. In her recent study of an isolated village in central Turkey, Carol Delaney noted that the villagers there use similar seed and soil metaphors to describe procreation. Analysing this further, she observed that the villagers believed that the whole child was contained in the seed, that is, in the semen, of the man. The woman, as long as she was not barren, provided the environment of nurturing which brought forth the seed to fruit. She uses the word monogenesis, a single principle of procreation. She uses this word monogenesis to describe this model of procreation, of reproduction, and writes that within this construction of procreation, it is the men who give life. Women merely give birth. Yet this thinking is not isolated to Turkish villages. It is the understanding of conception found in the ancient Near East. For example, one Akkadian text describes the role of women in procreation along these lines. It says, "My father begat me, procreated me, my father generated me, and my mother gave birth to me." And it seems to me that Genesis assumes the same monogenetic model. When God promises Abraham an heir in 15:4, he describes that child as one who will come out from your ma'im, from your belly, your inner parts. The child is understood as emanating entirely from the father and is to be carried by the mother. This model, I think, also explains, at least in part, the relative absence of women from the genealogical tables. The typical genealogical formula is man A lived X years and then he begat, procreated, generated man B. Life passes from the father to the child, and life is only perpetuated through the generations as it passes from father to son to grandson and so on. As hard as it is for us to understand this, women are incidental, or at least auxiliary to this process, because women are life bearers, not life creators. For the people of the Turkish village, Delaney writes that a boy is the flame of a lion, a girl the embers of a house. Seed is a kind of living torch that is passed from father to son ad infinitum, rather than a spark that perpetuates the line, women are the fuel consumed in the process. With reference to Genesis, we can say that men generate children, but they cannot do it alone. They need help, just as seed needs soil to achieve its end. Even though the woman is necessary to transform the seed, women's contribution is understood as temporal. The woman cannot create and project herself beyond this life. Once again, we must be willing to enter a different thought world. It is difficult for us as moderns to read ancient stories of conception and childbirth and not read into them our understanding of how conception occurs. But we should not forget that the existence of the ovum was not discovered until 1826, and it was not until the middle of this century, with an increased awareness of developed genetic theory, that we fully understood that the woman also contributes to the genetic makeup of the child. Vestiges of the old model exist today at a popular level. If you've seen the opening to the film Look Who's Talking, you'll know what I'm talking about. For those who haven't seen that film, it opens with a horde of sperm swimming towards to fertilise an egg. The successful sperm